Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Democrats and Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee came out swinging today. They're getting ready to vote on two articles of impeachment against President Trump for pressuring Ukraine to conduct investigations of Democrats, including Joe Biden, and obstructing Congress's investigation. Florida Republican Matt Gaetz seemed outraged by the proceedings.
Article 1, this abuse of power that they allege in the impeachment theory, is a total joke. They have to say abuse of power because they don't have evidence for obstruction. They have to say abuse of power because they have no evidence for bribery or treason. They have to say abuse of power.
Rhode Island Democrat David Cicilline pushed back with a recitation of evidence.
The president, in his own words, on July 25th, gets on the telephone and asks President Zelensky for a favor to begin an investigation of his chief political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. There's a readout of the call in evidence.
Which NPR is congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. Kelsey, Democrats today seemed pretty eager to jump in and respond to Republican arguments and motions. I wonder if you detected a different dynamic on the floor today.
Well, I think that the mood in the committee is absolutely tense and it is confrontational. I think everybody who is sitting on that dais today is aware of the fact that there are a lot of eyes on them and that this is their last and best chance before it goes to the House floor to make an argument to the American public about which side is right here. And they are taking advantage of that to the fullest. And that has meant hours of debate on individual amendments. Even if the amendments aren't going anywhere, they want to fight this out as long as they can.
And by the way, as they were fighting it out, did you hear anything new that has not been discussed in previous hearings?
You know, that's that we really haven't heard anything new, and that's not exactly where what we would expect to hear at this point. And I would say that listeners who are listening to this and paying attention should be hearing a lot of the same arguments repeated that they've heard over the past several weeks. In large part, that's because Republicans and Democrats are pretty dug into their positions here. Republicans are defending the president, and Democrats say they have a constitutional duty to move forward with impeachment.
Meanwhile, there are moderate Democrats who have talked about wanting to vote on a censure motion instead of those articles of impeachment. Why a censure?
Censure is kind of a less aggressive step. Some of them have said that they felt that impeachment might be a bridge too far or it might be the incorrect political answer to a problem. So they were hoping to pursue censure, though I understand talking to folks in leadership that movement towards censure seems to be dying down as members are realizing that there aren't that many people who are on their side.
So is the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi having to do much whipping or arm twisting from any wavering Democrats?
She said this morning in her regular weekly press conference that she is not whipping this and she doesn't have a specific message to send to the moderates because what she thinks is they need to come to their own conclusions. She says they've seen the facts that were presented and they know what is in the Constitution and they know that they've taken an oath to protect and defend the Constitution and that it's up to them to decide how they see fit to do so.
So they have a certain amount of confidence on their side. On the Republican side, as you said, there seems to be no wavering on the committee. We read about a charm offensive from the White House with movie nights and dinners to try and keep Republicans in line. Have any Republicans criticized the president's conduct?
You know, it's funny. They don't necessarily criticize his conduct, but the way they approach maybe a disagreement or any discomfort that they might have about his conduct with regard to Ukraine is to refocus the conversation about the fairness of this process. They say that Democrats haven't done everything they can to follow the letter of the rules of impeachment, that they haven't called enough witnesses or utilized their subpoena power sufficiently. And so when they are not defending the president on the the content of his actions. They are defending him in regard to the process.
And what has the president's response been like today so far?
Well, the president was tweeting this morning, very clearly paying attention to the hearing, tweeting about Congresswoman Veronica Escobar and Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, two members of the Judiciary Committee, saying that they misquoted his call. And so he is paying attention. He's also retweeting members of this committee who are defending him. But we will wait and see how he continues to respond as this moves towards the floor. And while he's trying to get major legislative things done with Democrats, they're trying to get a free trade agreement passed and spending bills, and they need to finish up work on a massive defense authorization. So the relationship and the response from the White House is going to be interesting to watch over the next couple days.
Very easy to forget all the other things that are going on while we're watching this. Just one more thing, Kelsey. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said the best thing for Republicans to do is to deep six impeachment when it gets to the Senate. What are you hearing about a Senate trial?
Well, I don't know that the Senate Majority Leader agrees with him. All signs point to the fact that there will be a Senate trial. We don't know the exact outlines of what that will include, but many of my sources are saying that they expect it to be more brief than necessarily something that will stretch on for weeks or even a month. There may not be any new witnesses called by Republicans, but they want to give this a sufficient airing on the Senate floor. And, you know, the White House has said that they want that. They say that they're looking forward to the process in the Senate, which they say they expect to be more fair than the way they perceive things to be going in the House.
Kelsey Snell, NPR's congressional correspondent. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The world used to see Aung San Suu Kyi as a symbol of peace and democracy. But now the Nobel Peace Prize winner has been defending her country against genocide allegations. The case, which wrapped up today, was heard by the International Court of Justice at The Hague in the Netherlands. Myanmar's accusers say the country carried out a deliberate campaign of ethnic cleansing against the Rohingya Muslims in 2017. Thousands died and hundreds of thousands were forced to flee to neighboring Bangladesh. The BBC's Anna Hologen joins us from the International Court of Justice. And Anna, there's a slight glitch on this line, but tell us, what is Suu Kyi's defense in this case?
So this was her defense. In court, she said, actually, it's too simplistic to characterize this as a genocide. She described it as a complex internal conflict in Rakhine State. She said genocide can't be the only hypothesis. And the way she managed to do this is by saying, well, look, individuals may have gone rogue. Some soldiers may have shot indiscriminately and failed to differentiate between civilians and militants. But the fact that we're investigating with courts martial and any action from this court, she said, this world court, would actually risk aggravating a very sensitive situation on the ground.
Aung San Suu Kyi is defending the military that actually held her under house arrest for 20 years. It's kind of perplexing. It doesn't make sense. How do you explain that?
Absolutely true. And there's been a lot of speculation over the last few days about how she is managing to tally the fact that she is now standing in court and speaking on behalf of the people who were once her oppressors. Some have suggested she might have Stockholm syndrome. Others say that she is obliged. She feels a sense of family loyalty. Because, of course, her beloved father, Major General Aung San, was responsible for securing Burma's independence from British rule. He founded the Tatmadaw, the modern Myanmar army, and he's considered the father of the nation. And we have to bear in mind, Aung San Suu Kyi doesn't actually have any control over the army. And it may be that she truly believes if this International Court of Justice were to intervene, it could escalate the whole situation. It might have to then go to the UN. The countries could become even more polarized, and Myanmar could be pulled even closer to China's orbit and away from the West. So it may be that she believes what she is doing here is actually for the greater good.
Okay, so what are the possible outcomes of this case?
Sanctions. So the ICJ has no power of enforcement. So if the judges were to agree to these emergency measures that the Gambia has requested, and they're threefold, really. First of all, to order Myanmar to stop any acts that might constitute genocide. And we've been hearing the evidence in court, some of it extremely harrowing of firing squads, lining the men up and killing them in front of their wives. Mm. Women, pregnant women, gang raped, mass gang rape conducted by the soldiers from the Myanmar army, children, babies thrown into fire. And so they've asked the judges to issue these emergency measures, but no enforcement powers. I mean, it would depend really on national governments supporting this, perhaps with sanctions, or it could be elevated to the UN Security Council. But then, of course, China holds a veto power there, so highly unlikely that would go any further. And the other thing to bear in mind with this is that the case was brought here to the International Court of Justice under the Genocide Convention, and any one of the 149 members of that convention, including the US, including the UK, but actually it was one man with one idea, the Gambian justice minister who prosecuted in the Rwandan genocide. He visited the refugee camps just across the border in Bangladesh, and he heard the stories. He saw the people, and he told me that he smelt the stench of genocide in the air, and he felt compelled to act because he couldn't bear the idea of witnessing another genocide in our generation. So it's really because of this one man, the Gambian justice minister, Aboubakar Tambodou, that we are standing here in The Hague today.
Mm. Stunning details. The BBC's Anna Holligan speaking with us from The Hague. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've probably heard of the Freedom Rides, when activists took buses from the north to the south to demonstrate against segregation on public transit. But what about the reverse Freedom Rides?
It was one of the most inhuman things that I have ever seen.
Get the full story on NPR's Code Switch podcast.
There's been a lot of news this week on the trade front. Today, President Trump wrote in a tweet that the U.S. is, quote, getting very close to a big deal with China. They want it, and so do we, he wrote. The president is to meet with top officials today. The Sunday deadline to impose tariffs on $160 billion of Chinese imports may be delayed. So far, talks with China have yet to produce an agreement. And earlier this week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that Democrats will support the Trump administration's revised NAFTA agreement with Mexico and Canada. That's a pact known as USMCA. But President Trump has launched another front in the trade war. Last week, he slapped new tariffs on steel and aluminum imported from Argentina and Brazil, and he accused the two countries of currency manipulation. NPR's Jim Zeroli looks at what the allegation means and why it matters to the U.S. economy.
Revere Copper Products was founded in 1801 by Paul Revere, the silversmith and Revolutionary War patriot. The U.S. Navy wanted to make sure it had a homegrown source of copper in case relations with England got tense again. Brian O'Shaughnessy is the company's current chief executive.
The founders of our nation were concerned about domestic supply lines in the event of a future war. And so Revere was founded on that basis.
The company's always been affected by overseas events, especially in recent decades. Nearly 20 years ago, O'Shaughnessy noticed that his products were being undercut by cheap imports.
And then we'd look at it, and then we would see that that foreign product is coming from a country that is managing their currency so that they can export more.
He says other countries were keeping their currencies artificially low, using cash reserves to buy dollars and flooding the markets with their pesos and rupees and yen, which made them worthless and made their products cheaper. That kept their factories humming and their workers working. President Trump came to office promising to stop this practice and bring back American jobs.
Any country that devalues their currency in order to take unfair advantage of the United States, which is many countries, will be met with sharply.
At one time or another, Trump has accused Europe, Japan, South Korea, and Mexico of currency manipulation. But the very worst offender, he says, has been China. There's little dispute that China was a big currency manipulator in the past. Scott Paul of the Alliance for American Manufacturing says it was one reason the country grew so fast.
I think it's fair to say that currency manipulation had an incredibly disruptive impact on American manufacturing, particularly in the 2000s. That was the period of time that China was able to turbocharge its industrial machine.
But most economists agree that China no longer takes active steps to lower the yuan's value, even though the yuan is hovering around its lowest level in a decade. As for Argentina, the target of Trump's tariffs last week, a different story is playing out. Its currency, the peso, is down almost 40% this year alone. But that's not because of currency manipulation, says Joseph Gagnon of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Argentina's weak currency is because of their disastrous economic policies, and no one wants to, invest in Argentina.
Economists say the problem for American manufacturers isn't that the yuan or the peso is being kept artificially low. It's that the dollar is too strong. Right now, investors are really nervous about the global economy, so they're doing what they always do in rocky times, parking their money in dollars, which pushes up the dollar's value. Scott Paul of the Manufacturing Trade Group says the strong dollar is bad for American companies that want to export.
The value of the dollar is an impediment to the export performance of American manufacturing, but Trump isn't helping that. He's hurting it.
And he says one of the reasons investors are so nervous right now is Trump's unpredictable trade war, which means the trade war is actually backfiring because it's making the dollar stronger. Revere Copper's Brian O'Shaughnessy says the overvalued dollar has a huge effect on company earnings.
Currency impacts the entire revenue stream, and so it becomes so significant. And so that's what's killing the middle class in America. That's what's killing jobs.
And even companies like Revere Copper that have lasted almost as long as the United States itself have lost ground as a result. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
It's easy to grumble about airline travel these days, but travel by plane used to be the height of glamour and global chic. That was especially true if you were flying internationally.
Who ever heard of an airline that goes around the world twice a day, every day?
The U.S. airline that flew the farthest and was considered the finest, Pan American.
Who ever heard of an airline with 87 first-class entrees?
They said a Pan Am flight was like a cocktail party with wings. The flight crews fussed over your comfort. There were elegant menus featuring fine wines and gourmet meals.
And all of this was cooked on the airplane. Caviar. No. Yeah.
Wait, you had to cook this all?
Yes.
So oxtail soup, braised sirloin of beef, roast duckling.
Yes, and we cooked it to your perfection.
Take it from someone who was on thousands of those flights.
I'm Sheila Nutt, and I'm a former stewardess with Pan American World Airways.
Yep, that was the term, stewardess. 50 years have passed since Sheila Nutt helped make history. She was part of the first wave of African-American women hired as stewardesses. Back then, flight crews were mainly white, and so were the passengers. After the Civil Rights Act of 1964, airlines had to start hiring people of color. In 1969, Sheila Nutt was 20 years old and living in Philadelphia. She heard Pan Am was hiring, and she wanted in.
And so when I went for my interview at a major hotel in Philadelphia and I walked into the room, all of these beautiful blonde, blue-eyed women were sitting there.
Nutt and her friend were the only black women in the room. But racism wasn't immediately apparent. Sexism was.
Part of the interview was, let me see you walk across the room. Did you walk like a duck or did you walk like a beauty queen? Your teeth had to be straight.
You also had to be slim and stay slim if you got the job. Supervisors checked to make sure stewardesses wore girdles.
On occasion, there would be random weight checks. And if you were 1 pound overweight, you did not get on the airplane.
And you could only get on once you had shed those pounds. Sheila Nutt had the look Pan Am wanted. She'd competed in beauty pageants, and she was a lighter-skinned black woman.
I believe that back in the 60s, they were looking for women of color who were not that different from what was considered the norm of beauty.
How do you mean that?
I mean color.
Do you mean not too dark?
Oh, yeah. In the African American community, there was a certain time where they had a brown bag test. There were organizations that would not allow people of color who were darker than a brown bag.
You're talking about organizations among African Americans?
Yeah. Sororities, fraternities, social clubs.
Sheila Nutt was the only black member of the flight crew on most trips. She says she rarely faced harassment from passengers.
You did have your anomaly. You know, somebody would get drunk, and then they would say things that were inappropriate, and you knew that they were drunk.
She remembers one particular flight to Johannesburg, South Africa. The South African government still enforced apartheid, the laws of racial separation. Officials told Pan Am that Nutt and the other black members of the flight crew would have to spend their layover at the Holiday Inn at the airport. The white crew would stay at a five-star hotel downtown. The Pan Am pilots and crew strongly objected, and everyone stayed first class. Nutt says in time, her race attracted less attention.
As we began to travel the world, we were known as Americans. Nobody called us black Americans. We were known by the passport we carried.
Did you ever feel like this was tokenism? Did you ever feel like you were there simply because the law said you had to be there? And did that matter?
I knew I was there because of the law, and it didn't matter.
What mattered to her is that Pan Am paid for her education. She earned her doctorate at Boston University. She started her own business called Flight Attendant Network, and now she works in higher education. Nutt has organized a group of women, African-American flight attendants, who call themselves Blackbirds. They include the pioneers from 50 years ago. And she's compiling a book of their stories of being in the vanguard of racial integration of the airlines.
We were hired in an industry by a company who didn't necessarily want us. But we wanted them. We wanted what they had to offer. So we made sure that we were prepared to enter that profession and then to take advantage of what the profession had to offer.
Give me one lesson that you would teach a young person based on your own experience.
We think it's really important for young women to know that although you may not be represented completely in an organization or a profession, that doesn't mean that you don't belong there. We want to teach young people of all persuasions, of all colors, that the world is open to you, not just your local community. You have an obligation to contribute meaningfully to the world.
For pictures of some of Sheila Nutt's Pan Am memorabilia, go to hereandnow.org and check out the blue uniform, a designer suit by Edith Head, and the fancy Italian hat, too. This is Here and Now.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
California, the nation's largest pot market, will now put warning labels on cannabis products. The decision will take effect next year. We're joined by Tracy Woodruff, professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and a member of the committee that voted on this measure. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So this vote came after you and members of the panel looked at research on the impacts of THC and marijuana smoke involving people and animals. What did the research reveal to you?
Yeah, so we reviewed probably several hundred studies. We were focused on the effects of exposure to cannabinoid smoke and THC on development, so development of the fetus. We looked at studies that looked at prenatal exposures and adverse birth outcomes. We looked at studies that looked at exposures and effects on bone growth and immune function. And then we looked at a set of studies that looked at exposure to smoke and effects on neurodevelopment. There were animal and human studies. And then we looked at a series of mechanistic studies that looked at how might this effect be manifested.
The evidence that you looked at, the research that you looked at, was compelling enough for you all to vote on these warnings.
Yes. So the committee felt, noted this in public comment, that the preponderance of evidence indicated that this should be voted on as a developmental toxicant, which then gets classified as known to the state of California to cause developmental health effects.
For the last 8 years, California has listed marijuana smoke as being known to cause cancer, similar to tobacco smoke. What will this new warning label look like?
Well, the warning label system will be carried out by the state of California. Typically, the warning labels have to be put up in places where these products are sold, and they have to say that it's known to the state of California to cause developmental health effects. And I know the system has been changing over time, so they may put more specificity on that. It's unclear.
We've had discussions on this show about the rising number of mothers-to-be turning to marijuana products for relief from things like morning sickness and headaches. And there's been a lot of pushback on many of these studies and this decision by proponents of marijuana use, that the studies that you all looked at only examined women who smoked marijuana, not those who vape or use topical lotions or other methods, or even the frequency of being around smoking marijuana. Your response to that?
We did look at smoking marijuana. That was one element. But we also looked at the active ingredient THC. So products that contain THC also will be identified by the state of California as known to cause developmental toxicity. So, for example, some of the animal studies, the route that the animals were exposed were oral routes, and there were comments by the committee members that they felt that that was actually very relevant to people who are taking marijuana in different forms, like you're saying. For example, there's been an increase in oral use. I would say that we don't have a lot of really good data about the percent of pregnant women that might be using this, but there is some concern there might be an increase and that the potency of some products may be going up. So, you know, there's other factors that are at play in terms of thinking about this product.
That's Tracy Woodruff, professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and a member of the committee that voted on listing marijuana smoke and THC to be known as a developmental toxin for pregnant women. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Lawmakers in the House Judiciary Committee are preparing for a historic vote later today on two articles of impeachment against President Trump. The first article is abuse of power, that President Trump used his power to pressure Ukraine to do him a political favor. The second is for obstruction of Congress. Democrats say the president obstructed Congress by not allowing officials to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry. The full House is expected to vote on the two articles next week. For some legal perspective, we're bringing in Barbara McQuaid, professor at the University of Michigan Law School and a former U.S. attorney appointed by President Obama. Professor McQuaid, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lisa.
Let's start with the article on the abuse of power, which came up a lot today. Ohio Republican Congressman Steve Chabot pointed out that this is the same article that was written against President Clinton. Chabot was on the Judiciary Committee during that impeachment back in 1998 when the House voted the abuse of power article down. Chabot said there is no criminal statute describing the abuse of power. Is that true?
It is true, but that is not relevant. An impeachment need not reflect a criminal statute. We heard from the professors last week who testified about how impeachment differs from criminal prosecution. It need not be a violation of any criminal statute to be impeachable. Impeachment is about abuse of power at its essence. It's about a president who has demonstrated that he is unfit to serve and needs to be removed from office. So that's really kind of a nonsensical argument.
Wisconsin Republican James Sensenbrenner brought up another point that I'd like you to reflect on. This related to the Clinton impeachment also 21 years ago. Let's listen.
The important thing is that Bill Clinton lied to a grand jury. Right.
crime. That is a crime. The article of impeachment that passed the House accused Bill Clinton of lying to a grand jury, a crime and something that obstructs the ability of the courts to get to the truth. This is not what is happening here.
What do you make of that point?
Again, apples and oranges. Yes, that is what Bill Clinton was alleged to have done. In this instance, the abuse of power allegation against President Trump is abusing his position as president to be able to communicate with other heads of state like the president of Ukraine and ask for interference in an election. And withholding military aid that he as president has the authority to do, abusing those powers for personal political gain. Very different from what President Clinton was accused of, lying under oath to a grand jury. And so when the cases are different, so should the charges be.
Could you tell us more about the second article, obstruction of justice? How is this different from the obstruction of Congress? So it's the second article is obstruction of Congress. How does that differ from obstruction of justice?
Well, obstruction of justice, you probably could call it either of those two things. I think when we think of obstruction of justice, we think of witness tampering, witness intimidation, destruction of evidence and the like. And what this article alleges is that President Trump obstructed with Congress's duty to oversee the misconduct of a president and have the sole power of impeachment by fighting all the subpoenas, by refusing to produce documents, and by prohibiting witnesses from coming and testifying. And so they obstructed Congress in its ability to learn the truth about what happened here. There was a similar article that was filed against President Nixon for similarly preventing Congress from obtaining all the materials it needed to learn about what had happened. And so a little different from the allegation against President Clinton about lying to a grand jury. Here it's about withholding the materials that Congress needs to in its role as a fact finder.
I'd like you to hear another point made by a Republican. Again, this is Steve Chabot. He made this statement earlier today.
This president isn't even accused of committing a crime. The Constitution is pretty clear on what constitutes an impeachable offense: treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. It's not treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors, or whatever other else Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff deem impeachable.
Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California came back with this.
There are no crimes here. That is the defense my colleagues across the aisle are putting forward. How about the highest crime that one who holds public office could commit? A crime against our Constitution. After all, the Constitution is the highest, most supreme law of the land. Every other law, statutory laws included, derive from the Constitution, not the other way around.
Professor, sort this out for us. How does violating the Constitution differ from committing a crime?
Well, the Constitution says that the president should take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That is his ultimate duty, the oath he swears to support and defend the Constitution. And so when he acts in his personal interest as opposed to the interests of the country, he is violating his constitutional duties. And so if for those who listened to the testimony of the professors and constitutional scholars last week, they talked about the fact that there need not be any violation of a criminal statute enacted by Congress to be impeachable. But if the president should violate and abuse his duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, then that in itself is impeachable.
There will be a House vote on impeachment. If it's a positive vote, then it would move on to the Senate for a trial. There are a number of witnesses who have refused to testify in a House inquiry, including former National Security Advisor John Bolton and acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Could the Senate call those same witnesses to testify, and would it be any more likely they would if the Senate asks? Is there more pressure there?
Yes. In fact, it really could be a fascinating scenario. So witnesses get called by the House managers who are acting as prosecutors or by the attorneys for the president. They can call any witnesses they want. What the witnesses could do, as they have done in the impeachment phase, is to assert executive privilege, or as they did, absolute immunity, and say they don't need to appear whatsoever. If that were to happen, the decision maker here in the first instance would be the judge presiding over the case, who happens to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts. He would make a ruling. Now, he could rule that, no, they're required to come testify. If he should make such a ruling, then the senators themselves have the power to overrule his decisions. The appeal, in effect, goes to the senators by simple majority. And so the senators could then rule, no, we recognize the absolute immunity and we will not require these witnesses to come testify. That would require a bit of a political hit, though, I think, for senators to say we're overruling the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So that could be, play out in a very interesting way.
And are House Democrats likely still looking for new evidence? And if so, could that evidence be presented in the Senate?
They could. They can really call anyone they want. They're not restricted to the witnesses who have already testified. That being said, I don't know that they will. I think Nancy Pelosi has made it clear that she wants things to move quickly. I think the Senate has an interest in moving things quickly. Mitch McConnell has said he wants things to move quickly. And then from as a matter of strategy, you've probably heard the old adage that a lawyer will never ask a question to which he does not know the answer. And the same is true with regard to calling a witness he has not previously had a chance to interview or have testify in a prior proceeding like a grand jury or a deposition. And so there is risk to everybody having witnesses come in and testify who have not testified before. So I think it's unlikely, unless perhaps House Democrats see that things aren't going well and want to throw up a Hail Mary and brand John Bolton and hear what he has to say. But it would be risky. But I think it seems unlikely to happen.
What about President Trump himself? Is there any way we could hear from him under oath on the impeachment articles?
Only if he wants to. He, unlike his aides, does have absolute immunity from testifying before Congress. It's a little different from the scenario we saw with, say, Bill Clinton or even during the Mueller investigation where a president is not immune from testifying before a grand jury, only has a qualified immunity there. With regard to testifying before the House or the Senate, he does have absolute immunity as a co-equal branch of government, and so they can't call him to testify. But as the accused, he has the right to testify if he should so choose, and so he could come and testify in his own defense. But just as a defendant in a criminal trial doesn't have to testify against himself, he would not be could not be compelled to testify.
Good to speak with you. Barbara McQuaid, professor at the University of Michigan Law School and former U.S. attorney. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks very much, Lisa.
This year marks the 500th anniversary of Leonardo da Vinci's death. There have been major exhibits around the world devoted to his artistic work, from the Metropolitan in New York to the Queen's Gallery in Buckingham Palace. But da Vinci was also a scholar in science and engineering, who, as his drawings show us, was obsessed with seeing if man could fly. Here and Now's Anna Benstead traveled to Florence, Italy, to find the spot where the original Renaissance man is said to have tested his flying machines.
At the summit now, out of the trees, and a view right back over Florence. There are a few picnic tables up here, and some notice boards with plenty of text in Italian and English. This is called Piazza Leonardo da Vinci, because...
È stato il primo esperimento di volo ad essere stato documentato dallo stesso Leonardo nel codice del volo, manoscritto che può essere considerato come la summa dei pensieri di Leonardo sul volo. Ma non solo.
That's my husband Lino, reading from the board that here was the first flight experiment to have been documented by Leonardo himself in the Codex of Flight. But the word legend is also in that text on the board. So did Da Vinci, more than 500 years ago, build some sort of flying machine and take off from the top of this very hill? The answer would require a trip down the hill, to the Science Museum in Florence. The Museo Galileo, a treasure trove of exhibits connected to the history of science. Professor Paolo Galuzzi is its director. He's a highly regarded scholar of Leonardo's scientific output and president of the National Committee marking this year's 500th anniversary of Leonardo's death. I cut to the chase.
So tell me, did Leonardo actually fly?
No, I don't think so.
Oh no, how disappointing. But wait, there's more.
I think that Leonardo possibly used one of his assistants to do the job. Was pretty dangerous, in fact, and the legend reports that this man who was called Zoroastro from Peretola, from a suburb of Florence, had some accident and some consequence. So Leonardo was a bright guy, didn't risk himself.
But not very kind to his assistant.
Not very kind, but I mean, he was already a very high recognized master, and so he had lots of assistant, and this kind of job generally is the assistant job.
So perhaps some human-powered flight after all, just not by Leonardo himself. But how did Leonardo get to this point, in which a jump from Monte Ceceri was more than just a leap of faith?
Well, everybody believes that his invention has been the flying machine with beating wings, which is wrong. I think he started with that, in fact, but he soon realized that was never going to work because the relation between the force of man and the weight of the machine was improbable, and no man would have been able to have the power to lift that kind of heavy machine from ground. So he make a change, and his strategy became that of observing the flight of birds and trying to emulate the way in which birds were flying.
Da Vinci went to the markets and bought dozens of birds, and he kept a diary with hundreds of entries on aviation anatomy. He was observing the birds to understand the dynamics of their flight. Professor Galuzzi says that, as far as we know, nobody before him had ever tried to do that.
He was especially focusing on large birds, like man would be, and not on small birds. And he noticed that those kind of, like the birds of prey, do not use so much wings.
Leonardo observed that in order to fly, birds take advantage of winds and air currents, and that led him to understand it wouldn't be a machine with beating wings that would take man aloft.
But was rather what we would call today a glider. He was empowering the human body with appropriate appendices that would make him more similar to a bird.
So the final scholarly word from Professor Galuzzi on Leonardo and flight?
It is possible. No evidence, but it's possible. We have drawings of this glider by Leonardo, and these are absolutely plausible. This kind of apparatus should work once that the conditions are appropriate.
Good enough for me. I can go back to the top of Monte Ceceri and stand in wonder at the thought that Leonardo might have perched here some 500 years ago, ready to launch, all right, not himself, but his assistant, on a flying machine inspired by the birds he could see soaring above him, centuries before a successful flight was formally recorded. This Renaissance man used his brilliance and careful research to work out how humans could spread their wings. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Benstead, reporting from Florence, Italy.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.